sociologist, which means that I study economic phenomena that stems from underground social influences. In other words, I'm interested in the interaction between social and economic forces and outcomes. The project that I'm presenting today is a project that looks at the sharing of digital goods on the internet and tries to understand what exactly is happening there, and more importantly, what do we know and what we don't know about this phenomenon. It's a result of a field work that started in late 1999 and continuing until this very day. So since we are interested in empirical phenomena, let's start with the empirical observations. And the empirical observations is that sharing is everywhere. One of the most striking things about the so-called cyberspace is that most of the content there is free. Most of the information, most of what you can get, read, browse, is free. And a few companies that attempted to charge for content were not very successful. And this is something that people often miss. There's a lot of information on the internet that is absolutely free. Here are a couple of examples. You can get a lot of knowledge just by browsing the internet and looking up information that somebody put there without charging anything for it. So the answer to all of these questions are online. And this is very different from what we observe in other arenas of human behavior. There are very few people that publish books and give them away for free. There are very few people that make movies and then screen them in cinemas for free. There are very few TV channels that are free. If TV channels that you can receive for free are financed by commercials, they're not really free. So what is it that makes the internet an arena in which you can get most of the content for free? And why is it so different from other places where people exchange information or knowledge for money? So the internet reality is that there is valuable information out there, and valuable information is an information where people actually derive benefits from using it. So if you want to know how to replace a certain part of your car, or if you want to know how to fix a certain problem in your computer system, most chances are that if you go to Google and type a question, you will find that somebody already solved the problem, and you can find a solution for the problem. So there's a lot of valuable information there, information that people seek, and people would ideally be willing to pay money for this information, yet it is freely available online. Second, there is mass voluntary transfer, which is called sharing, of digital goods, which is also even more interesting because you might say that, well, it is difficult to charge for a specific software problem that you solve because you do not really know if other people are in need of this information. It would be difficult to charge the money for this. You would need to set some mechanism to collect payments from them. So economists would say, yeah, they give it for free because there's no easy way to charge money for it. Not really because they want to give it for free. If they had a mechanism of micropayments, a mechanism of charging money for it, then they would have charged money. But digital goods is a completely different story, because in the case of digital goods, whether it's a movie or a song or an electronic book, there is a market for it. We know what is the price of a CD, we know what is the price of a single, we know what's the price of software, we know what the price of movies. People could easily set up a virtual store where they would sell this stuff. Now, it's not clear whether it would be legal or not to sell it, but they could have set up a way of selling it. And some people do try to sell these things. And the third interesting phenomenon is the open source software. Now, there it's clear, if you look at the case of Apache or Linux, it's clear that it is a valuable piece of software. People would be willing to pay money for it. It is possible, it is doable to charge money for it, but yet it is out there for free. Anyone can pick it up and use it. Thank you. are any questions or comments, I would be happy to hear them while I talk. You do not have to wait to the end. Now, yeah.
Familiar with this kind of technology, so I will not spend too much time on that. I pres-
presented this talk in sociological circles where people are not that familiar with technology, but this is a huge pool of files that contain digital goods. It is completely public. It is accessible by anyone. There is no supervising authority, and participants can hide their identity and presence. Now, it's very important that it is completely public, it is accessible by anyone, because what you could have seen potentially, and technologically it's easy to implement, you could have seen some kind of a cooperative, just like we see cooperative in real life, where people are making contribution to a public good, everybody knows everybody, so there is some kind of social supervision, and they all pool their resources, they create this public good, and then they share it. You can see it among friends that, you know, exchange CDs or movies with each other, and you can see it even in idealistic institutions like the kibbutz, in which people pool together their workforce, they create public good, and everybody benefits from it. The difference is that this is completely public, and it is accessible by anyone. You do not have to be a member of it to access it. Anyone can access it, whether you made a contribution or not. Now, if you go to a kibbutz, you cannot just go to the dining room and start eating if you're not a member of the kibbutz. So you have to make some contributions before you can enjoy the common goods. The other important thing is that participants can hide their identity and presence. So a common explanation for this type of behavior is that people are building reputation. But here, since most individuals hide their identities, most of their identities there are fake identities, it's hard to talk about reputation. Now, people can also enter there and nobody knows that they are there, and they can take whatever they want and leave. Again, because their presence does not have to be announced. Unless they make some active announcement, nobody knows that they are there and that they are enjoying the public good. Up reputation independently of your real identity. This is true. Now, the common explanation would be, the common explanation in economics for this act of altruism is that it's not really altruism. So if I give you $1 million to the Museum of Modern Art in New York, I get something else out of it. I have my name on the building. So I can use this reputation that I create as a generous person to make other gains. I can become a prominent public figure, I can become a famous person by giving away money. Here people can create reputation, but this reputation is not fungible. They cannot take this reputation somewhere else and say, you know, I am smiley face 123 from this organization, so, you know, now treat me better. Their reputation is very limited. So it's not clear that it's the same mechanism as reputation that is achieved by making large donations, because we do see people making large donations.
There's also examples like the Grateful Dead, who've been giving $18 million over the last few years, and nobody knows that actually. So even if you're not giving, you can have motivation to stop.
Yeah.
Nobody would ever know this money comes from them, but they do give tens of dollars on a 15th
basis. Yeah, there is anonymous. There is anonymous giving, and it's, to me, it's not clear why people do it, you know. For an economist, it's easy to say these people are just irrational. So these are a couple of lunatics that give away money, and we don't really have to worry about this because most people do not act in this way. And this is what I like about this setting. Because this setting creates natural controls. So I study a large scale phenomenon. It's not just a couple of strange people. This is an organization that includes thousands of people that all behave in similar way. So contributors cannot trace or identify those that benefit them. So there is no one-to-one exchange. Somebody just gives you something and you do not know where it came from, and if you post something to this file archive, you do not know who benefited from them. So you cannot come and say, you benefited from the file that I posted, now give me something back. Reciprocation is not guaranteed or enforceable. precisely because you do not know who benefited from what you created, you cannot come to them and say, now give something back. There is no gain from externalities, which talk about the fact that the reputation is kept within the group. You cannot take your reputation elsewhere. And free riding is present and known. Now, free riding is another important point, because what economists and also psychologists that study cooperation, their prediction is that cooperation persists as long as there is no free riding. Free riding happens when people take without ever giving back. So the argument is, well, once you know that people are free riding, once you know that people are taking from it without giving back, you will say, why should I be a fool and continue to make contributions? I will stop making contributions, I will just take. And then cooperation collapses. So in lab experiments, there were attempts to create this kind of environment where people were asked to give money to some kind of public good. And one of them was always just taking money from this public good. And experiments show that cooperation collapsed very quickly after people realized that one of them was taking advantage of the others. Now here, not only that there is free riding, it is known to the participants that there are a lot of people that benefit from their public good and never give anything back. Yet this persists. I didn't say that they do not expect anything. They do expect, but they still know that a lot of people benefit from the site without giving anything back, which is called free riding.
Then the site gets known as something that they are
to make it famous? No. This is interesting because it was difficult to gain access to these people. One of their concerns was that this research would make them too famous and it could cause troubles, it could cause problems to them. This is one of the reasons that I do not identify the location of this place.
At every stage, one would decide through the traffic, get a name, and obviously the people who are providing those sites in that respect.
And then what? What if they are famous? Not from this site. Because since everything is given away for free, there's no way you can make money off it. Yeah, I understand what you mean. But there are sites that give away digital goods as just like companies are giving away free merchandise for advertising. There are also sites that are funded, they give away free digital goods, but they are being sponsored by commercials. So it's like public, it's like commercial television. But this site is not one of them. Yeah. Yeah.
This is not exceptional. I mean, from your question, I hear, you know, where is the cyber? The cyber has participated for the last 5 years, thousands, and I'm exaggerating. I mean, most mailings would function exactly that the same way. But I think, I don't know what your answer is, but it's probably that we should analyze the social good that is produced collectively. Perhaps it's a characteristic that makes people behave like that. What we create is a kind of social capital. Mm-hmm. And the marginal cost of participating is very low. You can go in, go out, and you want. And as long as you participate, you learn. There's always a critical mass, 10% usually, of the people that participate. But that's enough to create a social good. So we don't worry about 90% not doing it. It's the 10% participating are the ones that at that time are the most fit and the most knowledgeable about the subject.
Yeah. This is the reason that I picked an organization that specializes in digital goods. Because you could say that these people are participating in to learn, and as you said, the marginal cost of participation is small. This is one of the economic explanations for that, that, you know, they learn from it, and the fact that it's there just helps them learn. But there are two differences here. One, I deal with digital goods. So when you post a digital good, there's very little learning involved. But yet I can show that there is cost involved. So it does cost you time or money to post it. You could, if you just take from it and never give anything back, you can make a positive gain without any cost involved. Now second, it was an organization that facilitates the exchange of knowledge, there's still an open question as to why do they do it in public? Why do they not create a group of experts where you know each other, you rely on each other, and you're in this small group where you know that everybody is helping everybody, and you can identify these people. And if someone does not help, you can kick them out. They could have created a website, you know, protected by password, and only people that they admit would be allowed to enter. Why is it that they let everyone enjoy their advice? It is based, I want to say without exposing too much of this organization, it is based on publicly available software, and it is stored on public servers. Yeah. Any more comments on this? Self-motivated is their basis assumption. It's like saying that there is no power of gravity for them. Right? It's like saying that the sun rotates around the earth. For them, this is the most basic truth, and everything else in life is based on that.
If you have a family, you have to do so much altruistic acts just for the daily routine.
Yeah. Research is to show that altruistic behavior is prevalent enough and explained enough economic phenomena for us to worry about it. Because as I said earlier, it's always easy to dismiss this kind of behavior by saying these are some kind of irrational individuals. So yeah, there are, you know, there's 5% of the population that does not think right, and they behave in strange ways. But since we can explain 95% of the population, then this is not a problem for us. Right? So what I'm attempting to show is that this is a large phenomenon, and it has important economic implications. Let's look at the phenomena of a little lower. Let's look at the phenomenon of voluntary sharing. So there are hundreds of thousands of music tracks in this case. The people respond to requests. It requires time and effort. And participators hide their identities. Now let me go through each one of them. So first, there are hundreds of thousands of music tracks. So it's not a couple of hippies that created this. It requires participation from thousands of people, and there is a huge public good out there. Second, they respond to requests. Now, there's a contemporary economic theory that says that people give just because they feel good by giving. It's called the warm glow theory. So their argument is that people give and they feel good about giving. So the very act of giving makes them feel good. But what I found is that these people respond to requests, which means that it's not about giving, it's about making other people happy. It's about responding to the requests of other people, not just creating it and just throwing it out there. It requires time and effort, which means there is some cost on the side of the givers. It's not freely that they give. And they hide their identities, which then again talks about the lack of the possibility of direct reciprocity. Now, in an interview, one of the people that often makes contribution to this public good talked about himself and said this: I love music and I'm fascinated with computer technology. I also like to help people, so that's why I participate in the group. We also looked at the type of interaction that happened within the group. So first we see requests for information, and the requests could be requests for a specific digital good, specific music in this case, specific music track that someone is looking for, or it could be a request for technical information that has to do with this art of using digital goods. There is also discussion of governance. Since this is a group that is self-governed, there is this ad hoc discussion of what are the best ways to organize the group, what are the best ways to organize both the vast collection of music and to regulate the contributions that are made to this public good. So there are instructions such as limit your posts to 75 megabytes per day. Check your files before posting them. Do not post binary files in the discussion group and vice versa. Although there is this agreed upon regulations, there is no formal way of selecting some kind of governing committee. Nobody has authority over the process. And if you think about open source software, we did some work on that as well. What we often see that the open source software, again, are not managed by any committee or by any organization, not even a committee that is elected democratically. It just seems to happen by some kind of vague consensus of the participants. We actually surveyed some sites that specialize in hosting open source projects. We surveyed the participants, and we saw that one of the biggest turnoffs, one of the biggest reasons not to participate in an open source project is a founder that is too dominant. So you might think that a dominant founder, somebody that is charismatic, somebody that is leading the way, is giving instructions and so on, would be a reason for a successful open source project. But what we see is the opposite. We see that if the founder is too dominant, people are less likely to join the project. So people are looking for this kind of open governance. Third, we see enforcement of group norms. So if somebody violates the norms that were presented there in the discussion of governance, they're being flamed, they're being verbally punished for their behavior. And there is also chatting and joking. Now, the chatting and joking, surprisingly, is just a small part of the overall communication in the group. You might think that the reason for this apparently non-self-interested behavior is that these people are all friends and they all know each other. Now, if this was the case, we would expect to see a lot of talk that is not about the sharing of digital goods, a lot of personal talk, a lot of chatting and joking, maybe exchange of personal emails between the participants. But we do not see that. Most of the communication is limited to either posting digital goods or discussion about the technicalities of posting digital goods. There is very little personal interaction, and if two people, it was observed that if two people were going too much in the way of personal discussion, they were asked to take this discussion elsewhere, either to another group or switch to personal email exchanges. So this is not something that is encouraged in this setting. Here is an example of request for information. How do I listen to a file before downloading? We observed that there were four replies to this question within 2 hours. Then the person followed up with another question. A discussion developed. And the problem was solved within 7 hours. Now this type of request for information is something that we observe not only within this specific setting of digital music sharing. We also observed it in handbooks that are devoted to the operation of specific software, specifically in the Apache web server. And we also observed it within open source software projects. An example of discussion of governance. Now the last point here was a discussion that developed in the late month of 1999, and the question was, do we need to create a specific folder for digital goods that come from the year 2000? And there was a discussion that was going back and forth between people that felt that they had an opinion about that, and eventually the idea was abandoned. The agreement was that only when the year 2000 begins we can create this folder. So this looks like, this might seem like a trivial matter, but to these people it was very important. Again, if you think about the fact that this is a completely open forum, anyone can access it, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of files that can be accessed, the organizing of them is very important. And these people devote a great amount of time to discussion about what are the best way to organize both the efforts of the participants and the physical organizations of the files. Here is another interesting case. As I said earlier, there was an established limit of 75 megabytes of posting per day. Now, there was one participant that made it a personal project to post all the albums of a certain group. So we promised that every day he will post an entire album, and he had a schedule for that. Now, one day he missed the schedule and he did not post because of personal reasons. And I know that because he posted an apology explaining that I had some personal issues and therefore I could not hold my schedule. Then he said, in the next day, I would like to post 2 albums. And he asked permission to do that. Now, posting 2 albums would take him above the 75 megabytes per day limit. And this is what somebody posted in reply to his request. He said, I don't understand and I don't care about your schedule and whether or not you need to keep it. And this is confusing because here we see a person that wants to make an extra contribution, and not only that this contribution is not encouraged, they're actually punishing him because he is moving away from the group norm, because he attempts to break one of these rules. Attempting to do that. So then again, here is something that is counterintuitive. You would think that once people are making voluntary contribution, you would say, sure, you know, whatever you can give, please give. But here we see a person that wants to give and cannot give because the group prohibits him from doing it. Now, I should mention that the group actually cannot prohibit him from making contributions. Since it's completely open and since there is no way to enforce it, he can post whatever he wants to. He can post things that are off-topic, he can post a picture where he's supposed to post music, or he can post software, or he can post thousands of megabytes per day. Nobody can actually prevent him from doing that. But the social control is strong enough to make this person ask for permission before he posts. A little bit more about the chatting and joking, which I said was not very common. And this is what one of the participants said in an interview. Because we are among friends, widely ranging topic and personal issues are sometimes discussed. But then he continued to say that this is not very common and it is often frowned upon if it becomes too long. A couple of more words about sharing. And these are again excerpts from interviews. We asked people, what does it mean for you to share? How do you go about? What is the routine that is involved in sharing? And here you can see the answers that they provided. Following as an explanation for what is going on there. He said the medium makes sharing imperative. It is not yours to begin with, so deriving personal benefit from its distribution is viewed as criminal. This is an ethic unique to the internet. Here are some of the implications of this phenomenon. Economic action is embedded both socially and technologically. So we cannot really understand this phenomenon if we just look at some economic assumption about human behavior. We cannot understand it if we do not understand the social mechanism, the social forces that underlie this behavior. Now, it's also important to understand the technological environment. One of the things about the internet is that it allowed quick, almost free distribution of digital goods. So you can benefit other people with little cost to yourself. You can make perfect copies of your work and distribute it freely. This type of behavior existed before. Some colleagues at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology did research on extreme surfers in California, people that were doing all kinds of trick with their surfboards. They also did research on people that do sort of extreme sports in the German Alps. And what they see there is that you see a similar pattern of sharing. So somebody identifies something, or somebody builds some instrument that is used for this specific sport, rather than selling it to other people in the group, he gives it to other people in the group, whether he actually gives them something or he teaches them how to do that. The point is that the distribution of the knowledge is very costly. They all have to meet to distribute the knowledge. One of the things that the internet does, and this is why I said that the technological environment is important, is the internet allowed to post this knowledge or to post these digital goods and duplicate them in a very large amount, almost instantly, and at very low cost to the sender. Altruistic behavior is naturally occurring, it is intended, and it is stable even under extreme market-like conditions. And I want to explain that. One of the beauties of the environment in which we did this study is that this is an environment that does not have the government. You have a lot of faceless individuals. So it is what economists would treat as the perfect marketplace. Anyone can enter and leave. There is no government. There is no taxes. People can meet, decide on a deal, make a transaction and leave. They do not have to meet again. So according to economists, this is the perfect marketplace, and what we would expect to see are a lot of small transactions between people. Think about, you know, one of these open markets for fruits and vegetables, where farmers are bringing their goods to a central square. Each one of them is small. Each one of the buyers is small. There are no monopolies. There are no cartels. People are just going to a farmer, buying five apples, paying for the apples, and leave. This is what economists would expect to see in this environment. A lot of small transactions that are happening. Instead, we see the opposite. We see the extreme opposite. Not only that there are no transactions between individuals, actually a large public good is created and anyone can access it and get whatever they want for free. It is the extreme opposite of a market-like environment. Since I come from a business school, there are also some implications for managers. And now I think that a lot of managers understand that, but it used to be a surprise to first that the internet is not an e-marketplace. The internet is not a platform that was created for businesses to make money on it. Whatever can be digitized will be shared. And this research began before the days of Napster, but after Napster I think that it's much clearer that they cannot ignore social phenomenon. One of the problems that the music industry had and still has in dealing with Napster is that they could not grasp the idea of this type of altruistic behavior. It was just inconceivable to them. And this is what I said earlier about this assumption. The basic assumption of business is that individuals are self-interested. Now, the problem with Napster was, and the likes of Napster, was that it was based on altruistic behavior of people. And since the cost of getting music from Napster was zero, there was no business in the world that could have competed with that. So we are talking not about a competing business, we are talking about a completely different paradigm. And this is why companies had such a problem dealing with Napster. It took them a while, it took them several years, about 2 years, just to understand what is Napster. And the reason they could shut Napster down is because Napster tried to monetize, Napster tried to make money off of its project. It had to become a legal entity, and then it was shut down. But as I bet most of you know, the sharing of digital goods is still extremely prevalent on the internet, and now it's not only music, but also software and documents and pictures and movies. And it is very difficult for businesses, when I present it to managers, it is very difficult for them to understand the mindset of why this exists. They keep asking me, so how do they make money if they give it away for free? And this leads to the next point, which is cooperatives and cooperative behavior are important economic forces. And here we see Linux and we see Apache, which are both example of the open source movement that had created products that are economically important and undermine for-profit attempts of companies like Microsoft to enter this market. No, you can make money. The problem was that businesses saw the internet as a platform for making money. They tend to ignore the fact that there's a lot of social phenomena that is going online, like this, for example. So they thought about it as an infrastructure for making money, just like the road system, that you can use it to put trucks and move goods from one place to another. What they fail to see is this is not exactly like the road, like a road system, like a system of highways. There is more to it. Where? Yeah, but you can use Linux without paying. We can use Linux without paying Red Hat.
Yeah, no, but you can. Sorry, you're saying this is not a platform to make money.
Let me clarify. I'm saying that it's not an electronic marketplace. The problem was that businesses, and still is, that businesses think about the internet as a place that is specifically designed or solely for making money. They think about it as a digital storefront, as a street where they can just present their goods and people will come and buy it. I'm saying yes, this could be done. But there is also there are also other facets of internet life which this kind of metaphor ignores. For example, this forum for sharing digital goods. So there is more than just commerce that is happening online. This is why it's not an e-marketplace. It's more than an e-marketplace. The marketplace is just part of it. To some extent it is a surprise, although they do start to understand things. And I did some work with the music industry, and I have a couple of articles online about it, where first they thought that Napster is some kind of a company. Actually, a lot of people thought that Napster is a company, and therefore it can be easily be shut down. They thought, you know, it's just a pirate, just like the pirates that duplicate CDs and sell them on the street. So you send the police arrests them, and that's the end of story. So they try to, and they still try to fight it legally. What they fail to understand is the sort of social behavior that is behind Napster and the likes of Napster, and the fact that if you close one of them, you have 10 others that open up. This was difficult for them to understand. It was also difficult for them to understand that the only way that they can fight Napster is by supplying a substitute for them. And you can see that it's only recently, only in the last several months, companies has put their entire music catalog online. And still you have several competing services. Some of them have only Sony Music catalog, some of them have only Bertelsmann and so on. So there is still not for-profit substitute for Napster. Although Napster has been there for, I don't know, for several years. So they had enough time to come up with that. They still did not do that.
Isn't it, of course, scarcity economics, I don't know the exact term, but for me, I think that's the logic behind it. The fact that this works only when you survive is not a state. You know, when it's an immersion behavior, people have enough to live on. Mm-hmm. When new needs emerge, that can be dealt with in such a way. But if you are in a survival situation, and this kind of loose, so it's on the one hand, a true innovation that comes from this kind of behavior. In my own experience, we worked for many years, the most productive times in my life were when somehow in a company I worked for, there was an opening, and for 6 months I could do anything I wanted, basically. Mm-hmm. And then I could really make something new that was does it for me and for the company. While in the usual situation, you have your objective and then you get it. And well, basically, you can only do what's expected. You can only do the
yeah.
But this is a situation where this is, as a rule, the case, where you can listen to better music, more music, but your livelihood and survival is not dependent.
Yes, but you know there are a lot of people that are making money and their livelihood is not dependent on it anymore, yet they do not start to give away things for free. I think that you are right in saying that we will see less cooperation when the stakes are high. You know, when it's either you or I that are going to survive, then I'm less likely to help you. But we see that even a lot when people are well off, it's still not clear that they would cooperate or that they would do things to benefit others. Right, there are capitalists that are very rich and they're still looking to make money when they're selling their next product.
Right, and they're probably looking for something else than money that would be number one or being having more power or
yeah.
Sort of be further than the next guy.
Yeah.
It's not the money itself
they still want to aggregate more, whether it's power, reputation, money, whatever.
I read something that I feel is a little bit related. I think it was Louis Mumford, I'm not sure. He wrote that the most innovation in history came from the rentier class. Mm-hmm. And until the 18th, 19th century, this was the case. The Newtons and the Galilei, these were basically a class that had survival issues. And so they had the means and the time to actually devote their life to their ideals and then come up with true and radical innovation. Mm-hmm. And so for me that's the same. It's because our society has created such a surplus that millions of people are actually able to do that. Mm-hmm. Through that they create true and radical innovation. Mm-hmm. And this is why I'm extremely optimistic, because it's not something. The big difference between the 60s is we had ideals, but we were not able to live up to them. This is something that's been existing for 30 years in the open source, and for 10 years on the internet. And as you say, there's no sign of disappearing in the country. It's something that grows by the day.
Yeah.
The internet is not a commercial thing. It's a part of it, but 80% of the content is civil content. It's just producing things and sharing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is the fascinating thing.
I think it's the opposite. It was very critically taken. taken over by civil society. There was a brief attempt by business to take it over, and they failed. Because the intrinsic logic of the net is not easily exploitable by traditional business thinking. I'm not saying impossible, you know, we can imagine a different kind of capital that would use it. But the basic idea, why was so much free material? And the basic, the logic was, I want to sell something, I need your attention. The only way to have your attention is I produce free information. So you come and look at my site, and in the process that you have your attention, like in advertising, I try to sell you something. If I start to charge for information, I have a competitor that will do the same. If I just start charging for this information, he will use it for free. So I'm obliged by this environment to give free information, even as a business. The only problem is people are not buying. That's the problem. So they saw it as an advertising vehicle, and but people are not buying. So for them it's only an expense. It's not bringing real money. So what they're doing is they're retreating from a lot of free information, but civil society is not retreating. So, you know, against the pessimists that see the internet dissolving, it's not. I mean, there's much more free information today than 5 years ago, and a lot more than 10 years ago. It's just continuously to expand.
Perhaps this is not a contradiction. Perhaps this is a place where both things coexist. You said enterprises tried to take over, but they failed. But as far as I read in economic part newspapers in last years, the amount of money which is made via internet still is increasing. But perhaps that does not contradict the observation that there is altruistic behavior also. But in my point of view, it would be interesting to look more specific on the conditions under which this behavior can occur, because I think what now happens is that they are trying to build fences, and perhaps they perhaps it's possible to make fences, and so you can't change music for free because it's not anonymous anymore or something like that. That perhaps the point of the line.
Mm-hmm. Who is trying to build fences?
Our governments who try to enforce internet service providers to log on the activities who is going in, who is doing what. Here in Germany we have cases in more political field where postings on the internet or on websites were followed by police raids 2 days later.
Mm-hmm. So the whole point of by the more realistic war of ideas is basically that today power is protocol. And so if you can control the protocol, you can then control usage. And I'm not sure, I'm not convinced by the argument. I think it's beyond that. But that's his point. We have to be very careful on how the basic infrastructure is. And if Microsoft succeeds in doing it, allowed you and stuff like this, then that would, in his view, prohibit at sort of a future point the usage of the media. And the historical precedent would be, you know, with early radio, we had millions of radio enthusiasts that were, you know, radio, chasing radio, and it disappeared basically because the radio was. The infrastructure of radio was changed, and the frequencies were given to businesses, etc., etc., so it was taken away. But I think that the internet is different because it's not a scarce environment. So I don't see how it can be done. But you are the experts here, so I don't know.
Yes, I read the radio waves aren't scarce anymore.
No, I don't. They're not anymore, but they used to be.
I think one of the other parallel, I think, at the beginning, again, historically, some of the project is quite expensive for private sector to initiate. The capital available in the beginning of the century could not possibly manage to put the railway station, at least some part of the country. So what at times happens through the public labor or public capital or whatever is so-called national, they can start it. But when the private capital can manage it, then it starts to privatize or try to use it. In some part, I'm not saying it's exactly, but there are some similarity of the internet. It is so huge, the business or private cannot possibly control it at this stage, but it will enjoy the thousands of the so-called people who are volunteered it, using their labels. In some stage, once it knows the dimension of it, it knows to the business, then like what they did with for example, water industry. I mean, water is not expensive in Europe. Yeah. Then private sector moves and makes profit. And there are signs in the internet, I think, that part of it might be.
So what's your explanation?
So finding an explanation to that is difficult. It's not easy because it seems to go against everything that we think we know about human behavior. Now, as I mentioned, we do a couple of other projects that look at similar behavior. We studied the open source movement. I have another project that looks at sharing within a company. We looked at engineers from different companies that share information, share technical information among themselves. We looked at people that are hobbyists of a certain kind of extreme sports, both in the West Coast in the US and here in the Southern Alps. And an explanation begins to emerge. And as I said here, it has to do both with the social and the technological environment. So to add to this, we can add data that comes from laboratory studies that are done by economic psychologists that are interested in how individuals are making decisions. So first, psychologists argue that altruism is not that rare. Altruism is actually a prevalent phenomenon, and they do all kinds of games in laboratories to show that people do act altruistically. Even when they can take advantage of other people, they would not do that. They would make sure that the other person would get something that they perceive as a share fair, even if the two people are in two different rooms and they communicate over the telephone or through a computer, so they absolutely do not know who is the other person, that they know that they will not meet again. They still want to make sure that the other person is not being cheated, although they do have the potential of cheating them. So they say altruistic behavior is not that unique. Now, from our field studies, both in the windsurfers and those extreme mountain sports in the Alps, we see that sharing of knowledge and sharing of goods within the group is also not the uncommon phenomena. It does happen. This is actually the rule of managing goods and information within these groups. The rule is that you share it with everybody for free. Now, my own explanation, which is still emerging, it's still not completely crystallized, is that altruistic behavior exists. We know it from lab studies, we know it from field studies. Now, when you take this altruistic behavior that exists and you merge it with the technological capabilities of the internet, you take behavior that happened in micro interactions previously between two individuals or between five individuals, and you magnify this behavior to a huge extent. So this behavior that existed before, thanks to the internet, can be magnified and multiplied to a huge extent, an extent that is so big that it has very true macroeconomic implications. So for me, this seems to be the emerging explanation of this behavior. So what we observe here is something that always happened, but we did not see it because it happened in micro settings among few people that even if they wanted to give their music collection to the world, they had no technological means of doing so. But once the internet is there, they can make perfect duplications of their music collection. They can distribute it at very low cost to them, and everyone can access it. So if I give my music collection to 5 friends for free, this is not a big deal. And this is not something the music industry has to worry about. But if I can give my entire music collection for free for 5 million people, then this is something that has vast economic implications, and this is exactly what we see here and in our other studies.
Just a comment, I'm not sure, but I do everything that we need, a socioeconomic theory of the firm, but judging by what I've heard, I really know that there is a socioeconomic theory of the firm. It's Herbert Simon and James Smuts in 1965 organizations.
Yeah.
It's as you say, it's not that people are rational or irrational. They say that there's bounded rationality.
Right.
Which is a socioeconomic theory of the firm. It's definitely lacking in some respects. I mean, at the time, technology had not been so prevalent as nowadays. But is it the firm or is it the network? That's what I'm asking. Should we analyze the firm? Is it within the boundaries of the firm, within the boundaries of the market, or is it the network?
This is my character. Now, what you're saying about Simon and Marge is very true. Though, when Simon talked about bounded rationality, he meant that even if people wanted to be completely rational, they could not, because of limiting of our brain processing power. So, he would say, we are making many mistakes in judgment, not because we are altruistic, but because we are stupid, because we cannot understand it. And the economists are happy with that. This is what I said. They say, 5% of the people give away stuff for free because they're stupid. So, not have to worry about this. What we are saying is that they give away for free not because they're stupid, they understand what they do and they still do it. So there is room for behavior that is not self-interested. It is rational behavior that is not self-interested.
Yes, but I think it's becoming increasingly clear that traditional economic theory is not really applicable to individual human behavior at all. I mean, what we have to do. The current market economy is the situation of companies and not of individuals. We are traditionally dealing with a company, with a supermarket, with a company we work for. We're not really dealing very much with individuals. Economic theory works. Companies, very well describes how supply and demand works within such a situation. But it doesn't work well for individuals because individuals don't agree with the economists. The economists think we should just keep everything for ourselves, but we don't think so. We think it's better to get a society where we share our wealth and we work together, especially when we are dealing with goods that aren't scarce, like information.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I've been missing in this discussion so far is where does the actual money come into play, because it's one thing to share all this information, it's great, but who produces it, who gets money for producing it? How do we make sure that the creative is actually rewarded in some way? Because there's no such thing as a free lunch yet.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually need to find a way to transfer this model of microtransactions to a situation where we also reward creators with money. And this is increasingly being done in some systems. I missed the first hour, so I don't know if you're familiar with these cases, but what you've seen in Usenet and in other cases with the sharing of information is actually increasingly happening with money. Some community websites have had huge successes getting their members to actually pay for their services, even though they were not forced to, because they realized that if they didn't pay, then the service would no longer exist.
Mm-hmm.
So such precedents exist, but not because people are forced to pay, or because there's some irrational second list. Well, actually, it is irrational second list, but not in the sense of the traditional economic theory.
Yeah.
So I think this needs to be empirically studied and find out how we can best reward actually the providers of services and
company. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We call it communal rationality as opposed to economic rationality. And I agree that it has to be studied. There's so many interesting things that are happening there that it's You know, this is just the tip of the iceberg.
Are you familiar with the called non-autistic economics?
None.
Non-autistic economics. You know, I'm not an economist, so I don't know the details, but apparently 1 or 2 years ago in France, there was a revolt of economics students. And basically they didn't like the way they were taught, which is the way you explain that, you know, humans are only bound by non-rationality. And so they created a movement, and as I understand it, it's really spreading like wildfire. Even I think in England there have been some changes in curriculum as a reaction to this challenge. In France, Jacques Lang, the minister, the reform minister of education, supported it. So they completely reformed the economic curriculum to take into account. And non-autistic means, you know, as if the economy were, you know, closed system that isn't reacting to social life. What I want to ask for this one is that, you know, if you look at history, much poorer societies like the Middle Ages or developed society were able to support one quarter of the males in the monkhood doing non-productive work. And we as a society, we are so much immensely richer, you know, we not seem to be able to do this. Because what I see is that we have the private economy that works, and I think it will work for quite a while. But you have this other economy, or whatever you want to call it, that's emerging next week. And so for me the key question is, what is the mechanism that will support, you know, the second level? I think that's the same question. So what you're looking for is a kind of micro solution where people would contribute. What appeals to me now, and it's very token, but I think it should really be studied, is the universal wage idea, whereby you take all the existing transfers that take place already, and I think the calculation is that we could give every single Western European 600 euro a month or something. You know, with the existing means, so just take everything that's already done now, take away the 40% that is lost in the selection mechanism to keep people out of receiving money. And that would be an answer, because if you have that, well, you just do it, right? You're not even worried about it, about getting rid of the power.
Universal.
Yeah, universal wage.
Meaning everyone.
Everyone. Every citizen gets a basic amount of money just because he's a citizen. Because our society is rich enough to actually do it. I mean, it's very counterintuitive.
You really have a difficulty to persuade, you know, the rich people to accept some.
Absolutely. I mean, it's quite utopian right now, but think about social security. I mean, it's you know, it was an invention of the workers in the early mid 19th century.
No, I mean, it is possible.
The first, it took no, first the one man, one vote. Yeah. 100 years of debate, 100 years of struggle, and then after World War I they were obliged to do it, because otherwise there was no social peace after World War I. And the social security system, you know, in the West, again, was discussed from the end of the 19th century. It took about 50 years, and then after the Second World War, again, because they couldn't do otherwise, it became a general right. So it sounds utopian right now, but, you know,
nicer if you have to take out one of the figures.
Yeah.
I think that will follow. Yeah, that will follow from it, basically. But there is a French book that I have somewhere. It's called Pour la gratuité. It's a guy who already wrote it in 1995. And basically says that one of the things that is co-evolving with civilization is the sphere of the free. And the more you things have for free, the more civilized you are. And it's true. I mean, we have, you know, free medicine, free education, and these are basically huge domains that we have taken out of the market economy, and where people no longer think in terms of business.
Let me ask you.
Can you step back? You know, with neoliberalism.
Sure, perhaps it's the other way around. It's not the fact taken out of the market economy, but it wasn't in a market economy, and now we have a growing portion of free enterprise education systems and so on.
Sure, that's a recent phenomenon, but I mean, historically, education was not free. I mean, the basic idea of the
marketplace. Well, it was for rich people who had the money to buy themselves tutors, basically.
I would say that this is happening now as a sign of crisis for the whole system. So, I think this is now a great point.
Most advanced companies I work in as consultant
yes, it did work, but it always worked as a kind of non-authorized natural behavior.
Yeah.
It never worked because the firm wanted it to really work like that. And so there was always a tension between the natural exchange, just because we co-workers and we want to work efficiently, and then the structure of a firm, which is not only capitalistic, but it's actually in fact feudal. I mean,
right.
A capitalist firm internally is a feudal structure.
Yeah.
Management by objective is a feudal structure. The chief has an objective, he divides objectives into divisions, and so it goes. And the reality is power-based competition. What I know that you don't know is my power. It's still, even though there's a lot of discourse about the other stuff, I have yet to see it.
Mm-hmm.
So my big question is are companies really able to make that shift? Or as maybe George said, maybe something else rather than a firm will come out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this suits what I observe in this firm, this specific firm that I study. The sharing of knowledge is not an official activity. You're not supposed to do it. They do not compensate you for the time that you put into it. People do it out of their goodwill. The question that I'm struggling with right now is what makes these conditions? Because we know that in some companies it does not happen. We also see cooperation that breaks across companies' lines. We see, for example, one of the explanations for the flourishing of Silicon Valley is that there is a lot of communication between engineers from different companies. The companies obviously are not happy about this. But these people are more loyal to their professional group than to the company they work for. So if you call them, even if you work for a competitor and you ask them a question, they will help you, although they are not supposed to because you are a competitor. Now, let me ask you a question, something that occurred to me a couple of weeks ago. Do you think that public funding for this type of organization is a good idea? So government supports, or government tries to create economic behavior through various mechanisms. Some of them is giving direct payments to people, like welfare. Some of them is giving all kinds of encouragement to companies, like giving reduced taxes or some grants for companies that would employ people eventually. What governments spend on non-profit organizations is typically thought of as something that they do, to be nice. They give it to artists, or they give it to people that are supposed to do good things for society. It is not thought to create economic outcomes. I don't know of companies that, instead of giving welfare payments to people, give it to some non-profit groups. They do not try to replace it. But what we see in this type of organization, especially the open source movement, we see non-profit organizations that actually create viable economic products that have create economic benefit for people.
But what they could do is create networks, citizen networks that would enable people to do it. And I'm thinking of it as libraries. At one point, the price of books went down, literacy went up, and the socialist and Christian democratic movement in Europe at the end of the 19th century had a whole struggle to obtain a free public library. And I see it now similar, the price of computers going down, computer literacy is going up. And you could actually argue that it's a social thing to do for the whole generalized level of society to go up, that governments would fund the emergence of networks.
But should the government fund these projects directly? You can think about a grant system in which you have an idea to create some kind of software, you apply the government for a grant, the government gives you a grant, and then you use it to create open source software.
I'm skeptical.
I see you shaking your head.
Projects, not one of them was genuine. I mean, not one of them, they were all just
repackaging it and getting the subsidies from the EU, I haven't seen one that, that was genuine research. So I'm very skeptical about success of this kind of
Something like your social wage, if everybody has the money, that means they can choose whether they're going to spend their time doing this, they can choose or doing something else, then they get the money. It's come through taxation from the government, but it doesn't have the element of control. So yes, I'd be happy with that.
We're having such a thing in Germany or in Europe. It's public funding of movies. Because of we need a national movie industry, and there are so much US movies which are considered to be bad because we are Europeans and so on. And it's a good example for the contradictions in such concepts. Then you have to make movies which are good for the national market and for the economic position of movie industry in Germany and so on. And in Germany there is on a very, very small scale public funding for software projects which are free software, especially for the new brightness regard. Mm-hmm. I think this is example, it was founded by our Ministry of Economics, and they have an interest in it. But I don't think you can go and say, hey, I have a nice idea, everybody gets his movies for free, and now I want your money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this is also my sense from serving people that participate in open source projects, which leads to a very interesting conclusion, because what you see here is a combination of a common ownership of goods, which is typically associated with communism, and at the same time you have some sort of laissez-faire ideology that says not only government should stay out of it, but we also do not need some kind of leadership to guide us. It can be done by the people, managed by people for themselves.
That's true communism.
The ultimate ideal form.
The statist communism was only seen as a transitory phase in any case. And I don't think even Marx talked about it. Maybe he did, but anyway. I think what Stephen Miller says in his text, you know, that the net is not a gift economy, because a gift economy, as traditionally conceived in tribal societies, was a very regulated affair.
Yeah.
I give something to you and you have to give me back more.
Yeah.
So I create an obligation to you.
Yeah.
And as I understand, it was a means of actually stabilizing the tribal economy and destroying the surplus so that, you know, it wouldn't evolve to another system. But on the net, it's different. It's a true communist ethos. You give what you want to give and you take what you need to take.
Yeah.
And this is so amazing. this is just amazing.
I think
any more comments?
In any case, I would like to thank very much for this very interesting talk and for the very interesting discussion. And trust me, I would love to see that continue on the initial tribunals list. So you might subscribe.
Thanks for inviting me.